get off the plane in Hungary and the JetBridge, rather than pummeling you with credit card advertisements, says, "Welcome to family-friendly Hungary." And, you know, you can hear the Twitter reply guys out there saying, but that's just propaganda, you know. It feels really good to have a society where public spaces promote normalcy.
Join the best in the movement. It's Conservative Conversations with ISI, educating for liberty since 1953.
Welcome back. You're listening to Conservative Conversations with Marlo Slaback and Tom Cerruti.
Today's guest on the podcast is Dr. Gladon Papin, who is currently a visiting senior fellow at the Matthias Corvinus Collegium in Budapest, where he's currently on leave from the University of Dallas, where he is an associate professor of politics. He is co-founder and deputy editor of American Affairs, as well as co-founder of the Post-Liberal Order. And he's a permanent research fellow and senior advisor of the De Nicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And he is also an alumnus of the Notre Dame Institute for Advanced Study. He directs the activities of Pro Civitate Dei and is an advisor of the National University of Public Service in Budapest. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Before we get started with our interview, we'd like to thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations with ISI. This podcast is a production of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, and our mission is to educate for liberty. If you would like to help us in pursuing that mission, please rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts to help us reach more listeners like yourself. So, Gladon, we have several kind of subjects we want to speak with you about today, and among them is your project with the Matthias Corvinus Collegium and family policy in Hungary. So, in part because we have a lot of discussion on the podcast recently where post-liberalism has come up among our various different guests, we'd love to, I think, get started, especially to kind of give listeners a sense of what post-liberalism is. I know we had Chad Pecknold, who is also one of the authors at Post-Liberalism at the Post-Liberal Order Substack back in, like, I think it was July or August. So if you can give us kind of a refresher of what that means and how it relates to your work, I think that'd be a good place to start.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks so much for having me on the podcast. You guys have had a lot of great episodes, and it's great to be here with you today. So yeah, post-liberalism has certainly got a lot of attention over the last few years. You know, in part, I think what's happening is that the right in present political situations is searching for a word. And obviously, in some way, we're all conservatives. We want to conserve the best parts of the Western tradition and pass it on to our children. We believe that's a fundamental human instinct and an aspect of human nature. At the same time, there's been all sorts of controversy over what exactly conservatism is. That's obviously why ISI exists and why this podcast exists. Post-liberalism, I think, has two different modes within that term. One of them is a prescriptive one, and one of them is a descriptive one. And just so I don't turn this into a 30-minute lecture, which is the tendency of every professor, I would say that the prescriptive mode of post-liberalism is, let's look at all of the sources of Western political thought, not just restricted to those that have been, you know, recently common in the post-Cold War United States. Let's look at resources in the Western tradition, particularly from the classical tradition, that take the common good rather than ever more radicalizing human liberty as their foundation point. Now, there's plenty of overlap in that with some aspects of conservatism and so on and so forth. We can get into that. But there's a prescriptive element. I'd have to fill this out more, but there's a prescriptive element. Post-liberals are known for advancing certain kinds of arguments that we should have a political discussion which is based around the common good, human nature, you know, preserving and extending elements of the classical tradition. That's taken post-liberals a little bit outside of the traditional matrix of, say, the GOP. The other part is a descriptive part. Since the end of the Cold War, we have thought we've been living in a global liberal political order. So that's a political order whose account of politics is based on a very narrow agreements. We need to agree that for the sake of peace and order, we use our liberty to establish government for these very, very limited ends. And it's taken on in the post-Cold War era also, that form of liberalism has taken on a kind of radicalizing and also evangelical sense. Everyone in the world needs to be made into a liberal, saw this baked into American foreign policy. So there's this sense of global liberalism as well, that since the end of the Cold War, in that long unipolar moment, which was dominated by the United States, we would see history itself turn in the direction of more and more liberty, and an increase also and spread of the particular political form associated with that liberal democracy. So post-liberals, I think, have both of those elements. We think that the political argument needs a perspective which is drawn from other parts of the Western tradition, even other parts of the American tradition itself, more from Catholic social teaching also. But there's also a prescriptive element that this world, which was dominated by liberalism, is in some sense coming to an end, that people are tending more to make arguments about what the purpose of politics should be, even if the purpose of politics is now to make people liberals. So the old form of liberalism, where liberalism just leaves you alone to pick and choose, navigate life as you want, has now become a more radicalized form seeking to make people make people into liberals, like make them prove that they are, you know, not bound by any unchosen obligations. And at the same time, that the global order associated with that seems to be fracturing, or in some sense, the expectations around it that the world would become more and more liberal democratic and be dominated by liberal democracies seem, if we look at China and elsewhere, not to be true.
I wanted to hone in more on what you were saying at the end and pick up to dive deeper, I guess, in terms of comparing liberalism and post-liberalism as, I guess, like juxtapositions. What, from the theoretical standpoint, what are the, can you help us tease out the major theoretical differences between post-liberalism as liberalism, whether that's, I guess, related to like neutrality or the common good versus just these narrow points of agreement that you were talking about? Can you sort of tease out the different approaches to some of those like important points of departure?
I think I might be most easily able to illustrate that by, just picking up something that I was saying at the end there. You know, when we talk about modern liberalism, people associate it with John Locke and other political theories related to that. The idea is that we'll limit the purpose of politics to something very narrow, like securing peace and order so that people can just choose their own path in freedom, whether it's, you know, expressing themselves through religious liberty or engaging in the, you know, unhindered activities of the marketplace and so on and so forth. This vision of politics set itself against the classical position, the position of Aristotle and to a certain extent the Christian thinkers, that the purpose of politics is to secure the common good and to promote virtue. This is just a very, I'm just making an initial, very superficial cut between kind of ancient, classical, and modern liberal political thought. What interests me, and I think what interests the other post-liberals as well, is that the new form of politics that's supposedly just about allowing people to pursue their own paths is becoming more aggressively a particular vision of the human person. And I think this is in the air. Like people, unless I've really read the political scene wrong, I think that there was a shift on this either toward the end of the Obama administration or the beginning of the Trump administration, that it's no longer enough for, say, conservatives, young conservatives at universities to be quiet and pursue their own interests. They're now being required to positively affirm that they support liberalism, right? So I think that's an experience that a lot of people have, and to the post-liberal way of thinking is just trying to track that initially as an observation. This political system, which supposedly was about allowing people to pursue their own paths, is now demanding their adherence and demanding that people show that they are liberal. You know, if you're a young conservative on a college campus and you're, you know, wearing a jacket and tie or something, that's suspicious now. You know, we're not going to leave you alone. You have to positively affirm that you reject whatever it is whatever the current thing is, whether it was Trump in 2016 or whatever it is on that particular day. And so that in the post-liberal way of thinking, liberalism is becoming more like a regime. It's becoming more like a system that has a vision of the human good. It's a vision tied to radical liberation. And so that's a shift within liberalism, and to the post-liberal mind, the correct way to respond to that is to say, yes, in fact, it is natural for politics to point in the direction of a vision of the human good, and therefore reacting to this by just going back to the same leave me alone demands doesn't really meet the current political situation. So I know the phrase, silence is violence, has been used in different contexts, but that's if you think about that in political terms, that's basically what's happened. It's no longer acceptable to quietly dissent, quietly be a conservative. You have to put your cards out forward and show that you are liberated, as it were.
Yeah, something interesting that I've observed among our students, especially our kind of in our most selective programs and among our students from the Ivies, is if they're conservative, they're definitely their affinity is for post-liberalism and more, less mainstream political orientations. I mean, during our honors conference this past year, among our Ivy League students and our, I guess, Ivy Plus students, nearly all of them were interested in these ideas. And I found that so interesting because I sometimes have to check myself. I spend so much time on Twitter and, I read post-liberal order Substack and, the books coming out of kind of that arena. So I don't like to assume that everyone else does, but I thought that was so just interesting. It was a really interesting observation that I had not made among too many students in previous activities that we had at ISI. So I'm curious, what do you think is attracting students, especially for maybe listeners who are students themselves, or, from the outside looking in, if you're not a student, what do you think is attracting them with, what's the milieu like for them right now? I mean, you're a professor, so you probably engage with a lot of students yourself, obviously. What about post-liberalism itself is so attractive to them, and what in their, environments, whether that's larger society or on their campuses, makes it that they're no longer saying like, I'll protect the liberals or the leftist students' free speech to, no matter what the value of that speech is, to now being more, wanting to turn society in a way that makes sure that there are certain values, mostly obviously aligned with Christianity, that are built into our laws, our moral order, things like that.
I think the short answer is that this phenomenon of greater interest in whether it's post-liberalism or integralism or the new right, I mean, there are an array of related concepts there. There is a lot of interest in that among students. And I think the universities have become a kind of laboratory for liberalism, right? I mean, they've been the postmodernism was launched in American universities in the 1990s. So they're always in a way at the edge, right there at the leading edge. And so you can get an experience at a university in embryo of what that the ambitions of that type of liberalism are. You can see it up close, and there's a very quick cycle from the ideas that are born in universities to important elements of public life, whether in politics or thanks to the dominance of the tech industry, which poaches a lot of very young talent and puts them in important roles as, well, at least till recently, Twitter moderators and so forth. There's a very rapid churn of university ideas into the public square. So I think university students are on the front line. So it's not surprising that they react in that way. On the larger question, I think there is a question here about, how do we justify and promote the things that are good? One tactic that liberalism and liberals have used over the years is to claim that all of the good things in society come from liberalism. So the rule of law, for example, is liberalism. And therefore, if you are skeptical of liberalism, you must oppose the rule of law. You know, so too with, I mean, you mentioned freedom of speech and freedom of religion, so on and so forth. There was a controversial moment a couple of years ago when the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban mentioned in a summer speech that what he wanted to see in Hungary, what he was trying to build, was illiberal democracy. And there was a controversy immediately. Well, Hungary is corrupt and has no rule of law and there's no freedom. There's no freedom of speech. Everyone lives in fear. There's no freedom of religion. There's none of that. Well, maybe the words were not the best chosen ones, but what he meant was that he wanted a Christian democracy. And what is a Christian democracy? It's one that has the rule of law and freedom of speech, freedom of religion, properly understood, but orders them in a different way. So liberalism, you know, didn't invent the rule of law, didn't invent, you know, didn't invent the concept of rights or freedom. These are deeper things that are found elsewhere in the Western tradition, but they're found in different contexts. And what has happened is that the more aggressive forms of liberalism have taken these things out of context and radicalized them. And so I think it's natural for, you know, a young person who's coming up on the right and thinks of himself instinctively as a conservative, you like the Western inheritance. Well, there's a strong desire now to learn what are all the parts of that Western inheritance. Obviously, we, you know, are Americans, live here and need to understand our own regime as well. But there's an important effort now to find out what is the original context of those ideas. How were they built in the Middle Ages? What were they like in the Roman times? What are these other parts of the Western inheritance? And there's a strong thirst, I think, as times in some ways get more desperate, to find and return to all of the sources.
That's a good segue into, you know, one of the critiques I've heard about post-liberalism is that simultaneously it's a sort of radical, as in fundamental reconceptualization, or I guess recontextualization, to use your words, of the purpose and ends of politics and of political life, but also at the same time, it ultimately cashes out into sort of anodyne or regular policy prescriptions that were commonplace up until, you know, 10 years ago, maybe. Blue laws or a more rigorous family policy, which I know you've written a lot about. I've enjoyed reading your work on that. So I guess the question for me is, what's the relationship between, I guess, what we call normalcy and post-liberal political priorities? Because I think that also speaks a little bit to what Marlo was suggesting about how at the Ivy Leagues or at some of, you know, our elite college institutions, which are very wacky and crazy, I just having come out of one of those at Boston College, that's perhaps another part of the lore as well.
Yeah, this is a question that post-liberals get sometimes. In fact, you mentioned the word normalcy, and I did write a post at Post-Liberal Order at the end of October called Return to Normalcy, which addresses this question or this objection. And as you said, just to restate it, the form of the question or the objection is, hey, I thought post-liberals and integralists and so forth were advocating this absolutely radical critique of modern society. How come it cashes out in the form of family benefits and industrial policy and whatever, you know, more aggressively promoting good cultural norms, et cetera? Well, I have two responses to this. And first is there's the idea of the Black legend. And the Black legend is the idea that pre-modern and pre-liberal society was full of darkness and foreboding. And there was, you know, the Inquisition and terrible things happened, you know, and then one fine day, you know, at some point, the pilgrims came to America and all was fine, right? This, not to oversimplify, but there's this, the Black legend persists and, you know, it hovers over the integralist project and the post-liberal project. Wait, you know, these people, you know, want the church to have an important role in human society, and they're, you know, returning to medieval sources for that. Well, you know, this is extremely dangerous, extremely scary. So I think in part, the expectations around post-liberalism and integralism have been set by hostile critics. So hostile critics are making this move, saying, hey, wait, you know, don't be careful of these post-liberals. You know, they want to return to the dark ages. And then, hey, wait, they don't want to return to the dark ages? Well, they're boring then. They're not exciting at all. So I don't know. For me, yeah, it's something like, you know, why is a normal and properly functioning society seemingly so far away from where we are right now? And, you know, not to plug Hungary, but, you know, I've been living there for the last year and a half, although I'm currently in the United States going back to Hungary in about 4 days. But there is a real difference between a society where things that ought to be taken for granted are still taken for granted, and one where we're constantly battling them. And, you know, I enjoy the battle. I'm a political fighter, or, you know, try to be in a good way. But my wife and I, you know, brought my wife and children, we all came together to Hungary. And, you know, I've told this story before, but, you know, you get off the plane in Hungary, and the jet bridge, rather than pummeling you with credit card advertisements, says, "Welcome to family friendly Hungary." And, you know, you can hear the Twitter reply guys out there saying, "But that's just propaganda." You know, it feels really good to have a society where public spaces promote normalcy. It shouldn't take a revolution in thought for a country to say, hey, corporations should not be engaged in propagandizing children with alternative sexual lifestyles in the public square. They shouldn't be doing that. Instead, we should have posters promoting positive images of ordinary family life. You know, I honestly spent a lot of time the last few weeks watching football, enjoying being back in the U.S., watching the playoffs, and so on and so forth. And, you know, people have pointed out, you know, other TV shows, commercials now, like they almost thrive on advertising dysfunction, like the, you know, exhibiting, you know, terrible behavior. The dad is always exhibiting terrible behavior. So it's nice to be in a country where the things that ought to be part of the public life are promoted in that way. So unfortunately, it seems that it may take a minor revolution in thought in order to change people's views about what is possible. In classical thought, last point here, in classical thought, the prologue to the law, the, you know, the section at the beginning of bills that come out of Congress says, whereas we, the United States of America, are dedicated to the cause of, you know, equality for all different genders everywhere in the world. Therefore, in this Ukraine military bill, we will include $20 billion for promoting gender identity education, right? Like this stuff happens in laws all the time. So you can think of post-liberalism and, you know, the way that we talk about purpose of society as just like changing. We need to change the whereas section. You know, whereas the family is an essential part of the common good, and its flourishing is tied to that of the community as a whole. Therefore, we can discuss what the steps are, take these steps to promote it. We can't just assume that the good things will, you know, spontaneously in some Hayekian way preserve themselves. So it is a good question. It's a good objection. And ultimately, I only have a question back to it, which is, you know, why is normalcy, 5,000 miles away?
It's funny you mentioned that, because I was in Dubai several months ago. I was, I think, 6 months pregnant at the time. And I'm someone who, like, my community, I live in Western Pennsylvania, is like a Latin mass community at my local parish. So it's, you know, totally very young and vibrant, lots of children. I think there's maybe an average of 2 children per parishioner at my parish. So it's not something that's foreign to me, seeing, like, you know, family oriented environments. But when I was there, it struck me just how poorly families and pregnant women are treated in the US. When my husband and I would enter the metro, and within 20 seconds, there would be entire rows of people sitting up or standing up to offer us their seats, me and my husband. And they were just so, so polite. And it really struck me, because, I mean, that just did not happen at the airport. It didn't happen, you know, in public transit in the US. So I remember even when I was in Hungary, I would see like, you know, pregnant women on billboards. And like, I think a lot, I know a lot of friends who have never held a baby before and, you know, probably have never interacted with pregnant women before either, whether they or pregnancies for that matter. So it was just like totally stark contrast between two different worlds to me.
Yeah. I mean, if I can give two examples from Hungary that jump to mind, when we moved there in September of 2021, and the main square is Deák-Ferenc tér, and in this square there was down the side of the building a huge advertisement. This advertisement was also all over the subways, and it was of a model. She was pregnant, and she was advertising prenatal vitamins. And I don't know, I was sort of blown away. Like I've been on the New York subway like a few months before that, and the advertisements are all for like hookup apps and, you know, different pharmaceutical trials and so on and so forth. And what you see out there in advertisements does affect your image of society. Now, you can find anything you want in Budapest, you know, good, bad, in between. It's a totally free city. It's well known as a totally free city. But, you know, I was on the subway pretty late at night. Subway is normally absolutely quiet during the daytime. But at night, you know, there were a handful of young guys. I guess they'd been to clubs or something like that. And they were still listening to music out loud. And I was sort of surprised, like, well, it's kind of unusual to see that. At the next stop, two, you know, older ladies got on the subway. And immediately, these sort of, you know, grungy guys, immediately they got up from their seat and offered it to the old ladies. And there's like, in some way that reflects the common good and orderliness of society. I've noticed on planes in the US and in other public places, now people are constantly like listening to their devices out loud, you know, like on an airplane. Why would you be, no one else wants to listen to this movie. Why are you doing that? And it's sort of like, there's a difference between a society in which, you know, a bunch of individual atoms are kind of like moving around and like crashing into one another and just kind of entertaining themselves, and one in which even the kind of rougher guys on the train late at night show some respect for their elders and for the, you know, common good of society. So again, there's no magic trick for that. And certainly, yeah, it's definitely not only Hungary. I've just happened to be living there recently. But things like that, they're elements of normal human life, which set the standard. And I think, you know, it shows that you can have a, you know, free society. You know, you can go out, do whatever you want in the evening in Budapest. But, you know, you're at the end of the day still respectful of those around you and not acting like, you know, you're just entirely in your own world and not a part of society too.
That's a good, actually, kind of to shift the environment or to shift the conversation over to your work on the demographic problems that maybe the US is facing specifically. Could you kind of listeners a crash course in your observations and what you see the issue is? I actually saw that there was a piece published in Compact today about making birth free, which I'm sure would certainly perhaps send that message that, you know, this is something that is worth being subsidized because it's for the greater good and for the common good. But I'm also skeptical of, you know, do people even want to be having children? Would they even take advantage of such a policy? What are your what are your thoughts on that?
Well, there's a lot to say, of course, but I'll just try to make a couple of quick points and then we can discuss further. But there has been a lot of survey research, both in the United States and elsewhere, asking young people and young couples whether they intend to have another child or whether they would like to have another child. And if you look at it marginally, like, would you like to have another child? The answer is almost always, well, yes, I'd like to have, you know, I have one, I'd like to have two, I have two, I'd like to have three. And I mean, statistically, not that many people get to three or four anyway, so it sort of runs out after that. But people generally want to have another child and express some interest in that. So I think the answer to the question is to that question is yes, people do want to be able to have children, but they evaluate that in different ways. People are apprehensive. Different people are apprehensive about different things. I mean, I've been married when I was 25, and you know, I was very apprehensive because I was a PhD student, and you know, for me, the apprehensiveness was like, oh man, I need to, the academic job market. I got married in 2008, right when the, you know, whole economy collapsed, and then the academic job market like completely went off a cliff. So that was my apprehension. Other people are apprehensive about different things. Could be the cost of birth, which the Americans United for Life proposal, Make Birth Free, is attempting to address, came out today, January 18th. It could be the price of housing. It could be, you know, it could be something else, apprehension about leaving one's current job, or you know, negotiating with a potential spouse about, you know, which career are we prioritizing? Where are we going to live? How do we do this? People are apprehensive about a lot of things. You can't address all of them. But overall, it seems to be the case that in a financially successful modern capitalist societies seem to suffer. And now that's basically all modern societies, because they're all becoming more economically successful. And as people enter the workforce, you know, they become more oriented toward their career and more apprehensive about forming a family and having children. So there are a variety of different causes of that. My basic view, though, is actually a slightly more political one, which is that the conservative movement and Republican Party, which is related to it, needs to do something now that abortion is no longer really the driving national political issue, especially. It needs to do something for its socially conservative voters. And I think my instincts come down to basically put your money where your mouth is. Like, the Republican Party should find ways to financially support would-be families and existing families and alleviate some of those apprehensions. And secondly, and this is a big aspect for me, it has to be done, you know, from an electoral standpoint, it has to be done in a very straightforward and easily understandable way. When I entered the kind of, I'm not like a career policy wonk, so I was with great apprehension myself that I turned toward family policy. But to me, it seemed like, hey, the Republican Party is very, very clear. This is 3 or 4 years ago, very, very clear about how it wants to address the abortion issue. You vote for us, we will give you pro-life Supreme Court justices, or at least Supreme Court justices that will overturn Roe versus Wade. What is the value proposition when it comes to the other things like support for the family? Well, maybe it's we'll rein in Disney or something like that. But it's really it's not clear what the very simple value proposition is there. So there have been a lot of great proposals for like tinkering with this or that part of the system. Like, could we technically work within this part of the Social Security system to repurpose some money that people, blah, 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 blah. From an electoral strategy standpoint, it has to be something very simple and very, very clear. So that, for me, that could take, I'm in favor of a number of different ways to do that. But I think the fundamental problem is that conservatives need to make their fundamental commitments into a successful electoral and governing strategy. So again, there's a lot there, but a proposal like Make Birth Free, which came out today from Americans United for Life, can you pick it apart and ask this question, that question? I'm sure. But again, what's the slogan? We have to come up with you know, this one weird trick that the Republican Party will offer its voters. We believe that there are still in this country a majority of people who would want to live in a society which values family, puts family first. We still believe that. It's possible that one day, you know, no society can, possible that one day that might not be true, even though human nature is fundamentally oriented in that direction. If we believe that there's that majority out there, how can we make that into a driving political issue? I'm open to a lot of different proposals on that, but I think that's the question.
Well, maybe as we're starting to run up against time, you might be able to close by sharing some of the things that you've seen in Hungary. You've sort of talked to some about some of the advertisements or the sort of, I guess, what's their cultural myth? What's their starting point centered around the family? But and since you're doing a lot of research, I've got to read some of it. Maybe you'd share with our listeners some of the proposals that you think would not only have worked in Hungary, because I'm pretty sure Hungary is, if not the only European country, one of the only European countries that's not in demographic decline, but is actually trending in the opposite direction, but also what your prospects or what you think the prospects are for how some of those policies may, could, or should work in the United States, since there are some pretty striking, I guess, cultural, economic, demographic differences, stuff like that.
I mean, first I have to tell you the bad news, which is that Hungary is actually in demographic decline. It is, it was hit very, very hard in terms of its birth rate under communism. And from, I think, the mid-1970s until 2010, the birth rate fell every single year. So they have, you know, started to turn that around. And I think successfully, at least in the last 12 years, the birth rate has risen about 30%. I think that there's a larger political and societal question, which is, do we want to live in a family-friendly society or not? I actually don't think that there's just like a magic trick on the birth rate, and I have personally not made that the centerpiece of my arguments. My initial foray affirming the American family and American affairs was not about the birth rate at all, which I find to be kind of a weird way of thinking. It's kind of like that's the thing that should follow from a well-ordered society, but maybe there are, you know, problems endemic to the modern economy that, you know, are always going to suppress it no matter what. The important thing is to have a kind of whole of society approach to family policy, to making a family-friendly society. So that's what Hungary has tried to do. And they have, you know, aimed at a number of different metrics. One is the marriage rate. So their policies that they've introduced primarily since 2015 have actually been around housing. So making housing more affordable for young couples and for making birth and early childrearing not only free, but financially beneficial. And so those two things have led to a couple of big changes in Hungarian society. The number of marriages per year has more than doubled in the last 10 years, and the number of abortions has fallen by about half or more in the last 10 years, as well as the number of divorces, I should add. So the marriage rate has gone way, way up. The divorce rate and the number of abortions have gone considerably down. What are the tools that enabled Hungary to do that? Well, look, it is a small country of 10 million people. They had a kind of propitious circumstance, namely that since they were coming out of a very bad economic period, they were able to build the economic benefits of their state around the family. America is in a different position because we already have a welfare system that is and a tax system, which in many ways are positively anti-family. So, you know, unfortunately, we are further down the decision chain or something like that. And we have, you know, sunk costs and things that have already been decided long ago. Still, changing the mentality and the mentality among policymakers has been my primary goal. So I think anything that can culturally be done to support the family is something good, including, you know, putting forth a good public image around the family, declaring a national day of the family, or state governors declaring, you know, this is the year of the family, and we're going to ask every municipality and city and county in this state, you know, to put together a program, you know, what are the resources that, you know, can be offered, and you gather together everything in one place, like change the public feeling around that. I think that there's a lot that can be done. The Hungarian economic approach is extremely generous. and causes some of our more libertarian friends various types of heart palpitations. But fundamentally, after childbirth, a woman who has been insured for the 2 years prior, meaning that she has been working for the 2 years prior to that, will receive 100% of her prior salary for over 6 months. And after that, there are also various other extremely generous things that the Hungarian system provides. So there was this controversy when the Biden administration decided to extend delay loan repayment for a while. I think that's caught up somewhere in bureaucracy at the moment. I'm not exactly sure. But there was a huge pushback from Republicans saying, like, these spoiled leftist college students who've gone to these expensive colleges, like, well, they should just work harder. Okay, fine. Certainly, I definitely want to rein in the leftist university system through, by any means necessary. But look, the Hungarian approach is a little bit different. A woman who has a child and has student loans will immediately get a 3-year delay in repayment of her student loans. She has a second child, her remaining loan balance is halved. And when she has a third child, her loan balance is zeroed out. So again, that's a conservative approach. The Hungarian educational system is a little bit different. It's mostly publicly funded. Those amounts are lower. It might be a huge problem in the United States. I don't know. But these clearly indicate different mentalities and different ways of thinking. And so, again, I'm open. What are the first steps? I'm open to a ton of different ideas, but I think it has to be something simple, something memorable that will bring friendly voters to the polls, because ultimately do need political power to advance that agenda. So I'm trying to change I hate the overused term Overton window, but I'm trying to change the Overton window of how conservatives think about that in the United States. And at least with proposals like Make Birth Free, I think rhetorically we're taking some baby steps, no pun intended, in the right direction. Also no pun intended.
Well, unfortunately, we are running out of time, but we'd love to hear about your experience with ISI. It sounds like you have significant history. And then also, if you want to tell listeners about where they can, find your work or any sort of social media plugs that you'd like to make, we'd love to hear that.
Well, far be it from me to recommend that anyone go on Twitter, but you can find me there at GJ Pappin, P-A-P-P-I-N. And, as you said at the beginning, I co-founded American Affairs. That's AmericanAffairsJournal.org. We're a quarterly publication that focuses primarily on economic and industrial policy. I've got a piece coming out on the current state of the realignment in the February 20th spring 2023 issue. And you can find Post Liberal Order, the Substack, on Substack, and also Twitter at Post Lib Order. So feel free to reach out on there. You can also find me, at least for the remainder of the spring term, in Budapest. So anyone's coming through Budapest, feel free to say hi. But yeah, no, as you said, it's I've been very pleased to be associated with ISI for a long time. They were a crucial part of my undergraduate education. I sort of grew up in an ISI household. My dad sort of became a conservative in the 1970s by reading Russell Kirk's Edmund Burke, A Genius Reconsidered. And he took Edmund Burke as his scholarly area. So he wrote about Burke in Modern Age in the 1970s, 80s. So when I was growing up in the 90s, like, Modern Age was always around on the table, and Intercollegiate Review, he was writing for that as well. So these were really the publications that I already knew as a youth. And as soon as I went to college, I signed up for ISI. And in those days, the honors program was held in Oxford. And so they threw us on a plane in summer of 2002 and took us away to England for a week. Look forward to ISI bringing the overseas trips back. Would highly recommend that. So yeah, I mean, it was really my gateway toward a certain part of Western thought. In those days, the debate was between the neoconservatives and the traditionalists. And actually, a lot of elements of those debates are still there. And I remember a seminar that ISI took us to, in which we discussed fusionism and the essays of Frank Meyer versus Brent Bozell and his criticisms of libertarianism and emphasis on virtue. And well, you know, plus ça change, things are still there in a lot of ways. A lot of those debates have come back. But what's the difference today? The overall political situation has changed. You know, in 2002, that was, you know, we had just invaded Afghanistan, we were about to invade Iraq, and 2003, 4, 5, you know, the Bush administration was saying, you know, everyone in Iraq wants to be a liberal, you know, wants to be free, and we need to go and liberate them. So after 20 years of that, I think people's perspectives have changed, but in some way, the debates remain the same, and ISI is clearly a great place to access them.
Well, thanks so much again for joining us today, Gladden. And thank you for listening to Conservative Conversations with ISI. If you've enjoyed this podcast, please feel free to head over to isi.org/resources to see all that we offer our members, including the Intercollegiate Review, Select Modern Age articles, ISI books, and of course, this podcast. Thanks again for listening. Don't forget to rate and review, and we will see you next time on Conservative Conversations with ISI.